Hello, and welcome to our first episode of 2022. Just before we get into this, I want to share some news. Yesterday, we had a paper published in PLOS Biology, and it's been under embargo for a few months now, so it's great to finally be able to talk about it. And I apologise for what was about to be a self-plug, but hand on heart, I just want to promote the co-authors here. This is very much their win, and I was just lucky enough to be along for the ride. So this is one of the best teams I've ever worked with, and if you find them on Twitter, tell them they're amazing. What we did here was we investigated the quality of all of the COVID preprints that were published within the first 4 months of the pandemic by comparing the preprint with the published version. This is quite a lot of work. It meant manually annotating and comparing 210 pairs, which was a huge undertaking. Ultimately, what we found was that both COVID and non-COVID preprints were broadly unchanged when they were published. Although if you want to know just how unchanged they were, you are going to have to go and read the paper. If you want to read the paper, there'll be a link in the show notes below, and coincidentally, we'll also be coming to you on German radio today, as well as a few journalistic pieces that are covering our paper in the coming days. Once again, huge congratulations to the team involved, and please do tell them they're amazing on Twitter. But for now, John, roll the intro. Hello, and welcome to Preprints in Motion. Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show. Today we discuss a really cool CRISPR tool and magnetogenetics. With postdoc and genius, Jakub Gemperli. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on. It's a really, really cool paper. I'll be honest, I didn't understand a lot of it, but it was a really cool paper. I think it's more Emma's field, actually, than mine, really.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I use the Teton system as well. So
there you go. So Emma might jump in with questions. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm kind of excited to talk to you because your interests align quite nicely with mine. You say you do quite a lot of adrenaline-fueled activities outside of the lab. So you've been whitewater rafting, which I've never done and I would love to do. I think I'd die doing it, but I'd love to do it. But you've also been to Via Ferratas and things, which I've actually got one, hopefully got one planned this year for Italy. So like, how do you find balancing that adventure side with science and you know the amount of energy it takes to do science?
I think if I want to be like properly relaxed, I need to do something like more crazy, full adrenaline. So if I'm like physically totally like completely like, you know, out of energy, it's like complete drought, then I feel totally relaxed. So this kind of adventure, kind of like water rafting, you know, adventure, it's, as I said, yeah, it's completely change your thinking. You cannot think about science during doing rafting, you know, so... That's why I love it, basically.
Yeah, I get the same kind of thing, actually, yeah. And you also travel a lot, and your top three places were all really cool places that I'm basically just highly jealous. So what were your top three places? Where have you particularly loved going?
I love Yellowstone National Park in USA. It's an amazing park, and there are so many animals there. You can see them, you know, just from even from a car, or you can like hike and then explore. Then I think Serengeti National Park in Africa. It's also like amazing place full of animals. You can basically see lions by yourself, giraffes, elephants. And then I would say the Galapagos Islands, which is, again, you can like directly snorkel alongside and see almost touch sharks, turtles. And also then you can actually get back to Ecuador, which is basically Galapagos are islands of Ecuador. And there you can go to Amazonia, you know, again, see some other animals. Then you can climb some really high mountains like Cotopaxi, just like at the volcano, actually. And it's amazing to see from the top, actually, to see the smoke coming from the volcano. Yeah, so these are my top three places. And if I can add one more, it would be Iceland.
I really want to do a hiking trip across Iceland this year as well.
Oh, I was going to go for my birthday. So my birthday's in February, and I really want to go to Iceland. And like, we haven't because of various COVID related things, but I would love to go and it looks amazing.
It is. Actually, the driving itself is just amazing experience. If you are driving through the inland, you are basically going over the rivers, you know, because there are no bridges. So it's also big adventure because you never know if you actually are able to go over that river.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very jealous. And then, of course, you've done a really cool preprint, so I'm just even more jealous. So let's get into the science then. So basically what you've done is you've created a system that kind of essentially allows you to reactivate transcription or silence genes on command, and you've broken that down into three different systems. So I think a sensible starting place, because a lot of acronyms in here, would be to go through each one, and if you could just give us a brief description of what each one is. So let's start with Dexcon.
Okay, so let me explain what's that. So we developed tools for precise control of endogenous gene expression. This Dexcon, it means basically doxycycline-mediated control of endogenous genes. And basically, by harnessing the power of tetracycline-inducible system with CRISPR-based knockins, we can now, as you said, inactivate genes. And this one is the simplest one. So as I said, we need to deliver to cells the transcription factor, which will bind the inducible promoter. And by delivering the promoter to the gene where you want, you can actually block the gene from being actively translated, because in this promoter actually are basically initiation codons, which will drive the transcription, but only when you want. The second one, the Luxon, is basically the same as Dexcon. It's just we are using a published version of a light inducible teton system. So now actually you can just illuminate cells by blue light, and now you can activate whatever you want, where you want. And because you are using light, you can do it like a spatiotemporally anywhere you want, basically. And the third system, which is my favorite now, it's called Dexogron. And it's basically a combination of Dexcon with the Degron technology, if you ever heard about it. It's basically, Degron technology is that you can induce degradation of proteins inside the proteasome. So you are basically controlling not genes, but proteins by, for example, adding auxin. So phytohormone, and I was trying to combine like Dexcon with Degron, so we call it Dexogron. So now basically we can like have a dual input, so we can add doxycycline and auxin together. If you do it together, you can basically balance the expression level you want. Then you can remove doxycycline, just keep auxin, and you will get a dramatic drop of the protein levels very, very, very quickly. Or you can just add doxycycline and, you know, and just it's going on and keep it high for microscopy, for example. Because I didn't mention one thing, but we are also adding to the genome genes for the fluorophore, for the fluorescence. So it means we can actually image the rescues directly because there is the fluorophore. That's basically it.
And now you've added another one of my favorite things in there, microscopy. You're ticking all my boxes. So, I mean, this sounds like a really cool system where, you know, you can get a really good idea for the difference between the role of a gene versus the protein, which is, I mean, it's one of the things I've come across a lot more recently in my research, is that there's a big discrepancy between what people are looking at with genes and what people find when they look at the protein level expression. So presumably Dexcon and Dexogron would be incredibly powerful together in that same system.
Definitely. I completely agree with that. Yeah, yeah.
So could you go back a little bit and just explain how you came about designing this construct? Why is it you wanted to come up with this system?
I have to say this is basically a side project. Because I got my Marie Curie fellowship and I was proposing to do something with CRISPR and with magnets. So basically, I wanted to control cells by using magnets. And because in our lab, we are studying RAP11 GTPases. And the one, my favorite one, is called RAP25, which is very often like not present in cells, but when it's reactivated, it's correlated with aggressiveness of breast and ovarian cancer and with worse prognosis of patients. But my problem was that in the cells I wanted to be using, this gene is not active. And then, you know, I wanted to use CRISPR, but then the gene was not active. And if you knock in a fluorophore or something to the genome, if the gene is not active, you will not see it. So, yeah. And then I have this like a simple, clever idea that why I can just reactivate it, you know, combining the CRISPR with the power of tetracycline inducible system. And I just simply tried that. I didn't expect it would work. And then second day, basically, I was like, wow, well, it's working. You know, I can see it. And also, I could see like plenty of cells, you know, giving me the right signal as I would expect, you know. So that was really great because I didn't mention it, but basically I was trying to for all the cost be not working with clones because, you know, clones, they are so heterogenic. So if you can like avoid working with clones, it's great. And basically our approach can be done without selecting cells as clones. So you can have it as polyclonal, and all you get should be after you sort cells by cell sort, because you're having that fluorescence as a readout, it should be all correct.
So that's your sort of basic system. So why did you then be even cleverer and build on that to do all these extra things you've done in there? Why did you choose to add that level of complexity? Was that out of like an experimental need, or were you just showing off?
No. Yeah, so basically, I wanted to have a separate paper as a paper showing method, you know, new kind of method. Yeah, and my PI was keep saying like it's not enough. So I was adding more level of complexity. And then I had like one student, very clever. He was like helping me a lot, and he was like driving me forward, you know, because he wanted to help me a lot, and he was helping me a lot. So I was like keep asking him, can you do this for me, you know? And he was doing it, you know. So and then we got this amount of work, which was great for big paper.
And why did you choose to add the light responsive element in there? Again, was that a specific need, or was that because you were already working with a microscope and so just kind of it made innate sense to add that element in?
Because it was possible, and because I found a system which was like really nice complementary system to mine, which I could use and make it forward with something else extra. And then I have like idea, because RAP25 is a GT-base, which basically bind vesicles, which will recycle vesicles towards soliding edge and increasing invasion. So then actually, why not to bring it forward and just try to do some correlation with cell invasion and with the exploration level, which we can control by light. And we can do it like spatiotemporally. It can just activate some cells, you know, in the extracellular matrix. Or we can just by timing of a flight, we can just, you know, make this nice correlation, and this increase the confidence, you know, of your results, right?
So with the light method, is that something you can use? I mean, it sounds like it'd be really good for organoids and tissues, but I work a lot with 3D tissues, and is that something where you can target maybe like a middle layer in the tissue with the light and focus the wavelength like that?
Yeah, I don't try, but as you say, it's limited by sample thickness. So definitely, I don't think you can target the whole organoid, just the top layer, maybe, as you said, top middle layer. Yeah, and that's actually why I'm now trying to work with magnets, because they are not limited by sample thickness. And you can even, I just read a paper about, you can even like control like mice by magnets. Yeah, in the paper they say basically that you can fuse one receptor in neurons, you know, to ferritin, and in theory ferritin binds, you know, like iron molecules. So in theory, even if it's so weak, in theory you can somehow influence by nanoparticles these receptors. And based on the paper, they're able to basically modulate the behavior of mice, you know, in labyrinth, the way that they were more staying in the area of labyrinth where there was magnetic field. And it somehow stimulated the pleasure center in their brains.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
We can all get little magnets put in our heads. So is this light-based system, can you tune that the way you can with the drug-based system?
Definitely. You can. Basically, the Luxon version of Dexcom has the same benefits as Dexcom, but you can do it by light. And the cycling can be, you can have like that on system or that off. So it means you have to add both doxycycline and light, or just light, and you can block it by doxycycline. So it's just how you want, you know.
And do you see any toxicity with any of these systems? Because, I mean, doxycycline can be toxic.
Yeah, but we are using such low level because we are using the third generation of tetracycline in the system, and we are using basically like almost nothing, like less than 100 nanograms per mil. Basically, it's like it's really low. And with the light, I bought BlueTorch from Amazon to doing that. So it's really weak light. I can even like use it directly to my eyes and it'll be fine.
Okay, that's really cool then. So that's a really good system.
But I should notice that basically I just used technology already here, and I just combine it in a new way. And to be honest, I'm quite surprised that nobody else before me just did it, because it's so simple to do it.
It takes the genius to put it together though.
Thanks.
So you made this as a split binding domain between the Lux and Dox. Do you have a preference as to which one you use?
In the future, I would be using Dexagron, just because it has all the benefits of Dexcom, but there is this one extra layer of, you know, of control. And I love on that basically with this system, what you can do, you can even study like immediate effect of gene knockouts, let's say, because it can be done like in less than one day, a couple of hours. And you can basically even like, let's say, keep adding docs just to be sure that the cell will not be adapted to the loss of the gene. And then you can just add the auxin, remove the docs, and just you have it instantly. And that's, I think, really powerful because, yeah, if you just do knockout, then very often cells will adapt to that. And for essential genes, if you have essential genes, basically the cell will die, right? But by doing this, you can have the both benefits. And actually, you can even like, the main benefit in it, you have not only KO, like knockout and rescue in one package, but because of the fluorophore, you have also like the imaging, you know, like it's a benefit. And because you can actually tune the levels up and down as you want, you can actually, let's say, for some systems, you need more expression. It's not enough to see it, you know. So you can just simply increase it up. And for something, you just want to have it really physiological. So you can go to the right levels just to be sure. And that's really cool, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my mind is just racing with ideas of things I now want to do with this system.
Tempted to be like, that would be, I'm going to present maybe this in my next journal club for my lab, because we do lots of CRISPR and Teton based things, and it's a really, really cool tool.
I think this is really benefited because this Teton system is already like here, so it means you can just slightly modify it in a new way, and it's working even much better than before, right? So you can be sure it will work, and if you just at this little level of what we did with CRISPR, then it's a new area of, I hope it'll be like a new area of research, because this is opening new avenues. And I try to demonstrate it by studying replevant GTPases.
Which is an excellent lead into my next question. So, like you said, you've used this to study the RAB proteins. So could you just give us a little bit of background what RAB proteins are and what exactly it was you've used this system for?
So we are studying RAP GTPases, RAP11 family, basically, which are well known that they are recycling vesicles from cell body to the cell front, and is somehow allowing cells to effectively migrate, for example, invade if it's cancer cell, because these vesicles are recycling receptors for binding to extracellular matrix. So if you basically modify the genes to see it, you should be able to see like vesicles going, recycling all the time and going to different parts of the cells. And yeah, and these three members, cell phone A, B, and 25, they are well known that they somehow can have a relevance on breast and ovarian cancer. So very often, at least cell phone 25 is well known, as I said before, that if it's basically reactivated from genome because it's not ubiquitous, especially this one, it leads to something really bad. And I decided to study these three genes because in our lab, in Patrick Asfel lab where I am, we are studying them, and also it's kind of, they are quite similar, and especially if you want to try to study similar, you know, genes, it's very often hard to study by using antibodies. That's one thing. Yeah, and that's it, I think.
But this is not what your fellowship is on, correct?
It's not. It's partially, it's partially not. As I said, I propose to use magnets to control cells, to control vesicles, basically to control RAP25 vesicles. And yeah, in the beginning, because in order to do it, I need to modify the gene the way I can then allow binding of nanoparticles, which are magnetic, which I can control by magnets. So when you do it, I need to modify the gene. But as I said, the RAP25 was not present in the cells I was trying to study. And also I found one really big pitfall I was not aware of before, because I was following like the top newest preprints at the time to be on the top of the novelty of the research, you know, just to keep going. And I was not aware that if you try to do knock-in, like to integrate a gene in front of one gene, very often it's got truncated. So it means you get like non-complete integrations. And even though if you do it the best way possible, because there are multiple options how you can do it, if you do it the best way possible, very often you get truncation in the knock-in, so it's not fully integrated. And I found that basically during like first year I was doing it, and then my Dexcom actually saved it as well, because if you use basically the Dexcom module, the promoter there, basically then you can basically knock in also a gene which is not fluorescent, because normally we are using only for knocking of genes for fluorescence. And then by fluorescent by sorting, you can sort the one which did it the right way, so you don't have to have clones. And if you use Dexcom module, you can actually sort something else as well, which is not fluorescent, and it'd be full length, which is great. So right now, I am able to do it. And now I have basically, let's say, nanobody against GFP. So I have nanobody knocking in front of RF25 gene. And then I have nanoparticles which are functionalized by GFP. So I can see them. They are green inside the cell. And now if I basically add nanoparticles to cells, they are green because they are, you know, having GFP. And then my vesicles are having also mCherry there. So I can see them. They are red. They will bind in a couple of seconds together. So now I have all the vesicles inside the cell, red and green. And now I'm trying to move using, let's say, a magnetic tip connected to micromanipulator. And I'm moving with the tip, and then the vesicles are following my movement, which is, I think, quite cool. And then I'm trying actually to see what will happen with the cell protrusions. Will the cell move my way or not? And yeah, it's quite big fun.
So you described it as controlling cancer cells like puppets. And I could not imagine some crazy evil scientists just hovering over the cell culture dishes. So, I mean, when you're doing this, presumably there is a limit as to how much of these particles you can get inside of a cell before you just start moving the cell, right? Because can't have it too magnetic, I guess.
I think the biggest problem is you cannot, like, fuck the cells. You need to basically be sure that the cell is still quite healthy. And if you put just too much of it, just too much volume, the cell will die or will not follow you. So the cytoskeleton has to be intact. So that's actually, at the beginning, was quite a big problem because I was trying to do it here in Manchester, and I was actually going for 2 weeks to Germany. There actually they were helping me to start with magnets, with magnetogenetics, because it's quite hard to start from your own. And I think you can't do it by your own. You have to have help. So I got great help from Germany. Thank you, Germany. and then I got back to Manchester, and basically, yeah, there was nice microscopes, but system was not built. So I had to help to Peter March, which basically he's a great guy. He can even build the microscope from scratch. And he helped me to find micromanipulator, which was like full of dust in the corner, you know, not used for 10 years. Then he helped me to localize the pump for microinjection, also in other lab, like 10 years not used, you know, full of dust. And then he helped me to assemble this around the spinning disc. He even helped me to build a chamber from a cardboard. So I have now a cardboard around the microscope to give 37 degree. And then, yes, then I started doing it to have fun, yeah.
So how did you come across this field to begin with? Because I mean, it wasn't my experience with anything magnetic and cells is just those kits you get when you're isolating cells out from a sample. That's about as far as I get with that, and they're just antibodies that have a bit of metal bound to them, really. So how did you actually fall into this?
Yeah, so I will always like to have a fun with artificial systems, and I was always trying to do more stuff with CRISPR. And then, as I said, I basically 4 years ago I met Pat, my current boss PI, on the conference in Paris, and basically he was great. We had nice time, you know, drinking wine, you know. And then I had like feeling it'd be great to be in his lab. And then basically we tried to find a funding for me in advance, and basically, in order to get Marie Curie fellowship, which I got at the end, you need to come with something really crazy, something like groundbreaking, a lot novel. You also somehow need to be able to demonstrate it's possible. You are the best guy to do it, and the lab you are going is the best lab you should be going. Yeah, and somehow I was like reading literature, trying to find cool stuff, and then I approached magnets, and then I knew this is it. I want to do it because it's so amazing. I can be a big fan, and actually because of my publications before, I basically had something which was like something I could be using for the preparation of the nanoparticles, and also I wanted to apply it in a new context, cancer-relevant context. So it was basically Pat's lab, the best lab I could be doing it. We somehow persuaded the committee it's possible to do it.
How do you find Manchester? So we were, the team here is all from Sheffield, where we did our PhDs. And I mean, Sheffield's great, but Manchester's a great city. And the university there is really nice. I once went over to have help with a new technique as well, and it was lovely.
Yeah, it's lovely, but it's raining a lot, I have to say.
Yeah, you get all the rain, Sheffield gets none of it, it's great.
Actually, Sheffield is great. I've also been in Sheffield 3 times. Water skiing. Have you been doing water skiing?
No. There? Where did you do that in Sheffield?
There's water skiing in Sheffield?
Yes. What? Yes. And I have been already 3 to 4 times. There's like a big pond, and it's there, and it's like lovely. There's like a circle lift going around on that lake. And it will just, you know, like catch the lift, and then you are going around on skis or on wakeboard.
Well, we missed out on this.
Well, we can always go back, Johnny. We know enough people.
So It just so happens that this week I've been, well, for the past 2 weeks, I've been doing this thing online with school kids where they basically just ask a scientist questions. It's supposed to be pandemic related, but to be honest, they've been asking anything from pandemic questions to what's your favourite ice cream flavour? And one of the questions you asked us in the little form we get our guests to fill out is one of the questions that has kind of come up a bit. So I thought it might be interesting to discuss. So a lot of this work is very much down the route of modifying genes. Eventually, the aim would be to do this in animals. So you asked us what we think about sort of gene modifications and the ethics associated with that, which I've answered a lot the past 2 weeks. But how do you feel about that? Because it is there's strong arguments on both sides with that kind of thing. And I mean, do you have any sort of hard lines where you think it would go too far? It could go too far?
Yeah, that's the thing. My feeling, because I'm really crazy, my feeling is that that ethics in this kind of research is really slowing down the progress. And very often, if you don't try, you don't know, right? Mm. And I understand why people are afraid, or ethics is very important to be here. It has to be here. But my feeling is, for example, like studying human embryos, you can't do it longer than 2 weeks after it's implanted to the womb. So basically, you can't know what will happen after. But if you don't study it, if they even don't allow it, you never know. And for example, if I can follow on this, I tell it to my friends all the time. It would be so great, because right now there's technology and it's already like 5 years old, to be able to produce human organs in pigs, which would be your own organs grown in pigs. And technology is here. We just are not doing it because of ethics. And yeah. And I think in news now it was that in USA, they I think use pigs, pig heart to yes. for human. And wouldn't it be much better to use a human heart grown in pigs delivered to humans?
Yeah, so this was the first time they've ever transplanted a human pig into a human pig, a pig heart into a human. Oh, it's been such a long day. I've been at work since 6 o'clock this morning. But yeah, no, it was fascinating. And actually, it's funny you mentioned the pig stuff, because that has, I think it was like 10 years ago, it was one of those things where they go, where's science going to be in 10 years? And that, I think, was actually on the list. We were going to start, growing human organs in pigs. And it is kind of strange that it hasn't happened yet. I mean, do you think it will happen? Yeah. Is this something you think the ethics will change on?
I hope. I think the now problem why they don't want to progress is that because you can inactivate any gene you want in a pig embryo, and then you can add your human cells. For example, even like you can take your skin cells, redifferentiate it to pluripotent stem cells, put it back, to the embryo. And then from the embryo, only your cells will rise to the organ you want. So it means, for example, if you need your heart, you can activate the gene for heart development in the embryo of pig. You can inject your stem cell to the embryo and you will get your own heart. The problem is why ethics, is still here preventing any progress, is because your cells can theory also give rise to something else. For example, partially of the pig's brain, for example, or different organs. And then you don't know if the pig at the end, who will be still pig, or is it partially human? Can it actually speak, or can it think as a human? And that's a big problem. But that's a problem, right? If you don't try it, you don't know, right? But to me, I think we are so different, pigs from humans, that I would be so surprised if this would be possible. I can imagine like a couple of cells, going to the brain, but I don't think they will change anything.
So that was, again, just weirdly, watching a documentary about Dolly the sheep recently. I think it's on Netflix. If anyone has seen it, it's really good. Might be on iPlayer. Anyway, there's a Dolly the Sheep documentary out there. It's quite interesting. And yeah, it was kind of focused on the media reaction to the particular science that was involved in that. And it was really interesting to see just how the general public respond to that, but also how quickly everyone just stops caring again. And it was amazing because it was like top news for quite a little while and then just suddenly nothing and nobody cared anymore. And then nobody cared again until Dolly died. So it's public opinion sways surprisingly quickly.
Yeah.
And that has surprisingly been a very smooth segue into the preprinting part of the chat. So you've already said sort of some of the benefits you've had from preprints, so that you read them to be on the cutting edge of what's going on. But why? Whose decision was it to preprint this work? Was that you or was it the PI?
Both me and my PI, we are publishing as preprints papers first. But for me, this decision came already like before I was in his lab. And actually, the reason I got my Marie Curie Fellowship I have to stress it. The reason I got it is because I could publish preprints. And because if I would not have it out as a preprint, I would not get it. So this really helped me, and it really counts. If you have preprint out, it really counts, because it's proof you have the whole story out. And usually if you can just open it and read it, you can say it's really good paper or bad, just based on you see it. And to be honest, actually, I think it's if you have a paper like in Nature or preprint like in PLOS One, the one in PLOS One came is still better. So actually people should still, you know, be looking at it directly and not just be judging your paper based on the journal, right?
Yeah, I had this argument with a friend when we had him on the podcast not long ago. He likes to read journals, whereas I try and make the point that actually you should be reading the paper, not the journal. But I think we agreed on some nice middle ground somewhere to keep the peace. So, I mean, have you got any other benefits from preprinting? Because, I mean, it's a really cool... I picked this up quite a bit on Twitter, so it's gotten some attention at least.
I have to say, yeah, that I could also, you know, now I have my preprint, so the benefit is people can follow much sooner, much faster. Mm. They can also, like, you know, if they find out that I did something horribly wrong, they can just tell me and I will know sooner before I will, you know, make it forward with this. And... yeah, and also thanks to that, I could actually tweet it on Twitter. And also Twitter, I was so surprised how powerful it is. Mm. So thanks to that, I think you also found it, right?
Yeah, we find most of the papers for this through Twitter, actually. Mm. It's a good way of figuring out what are good preprints, actually, because the good ones tend to get quite a lot of attention.
Yeah, but sometimes even like, you know, even bad papers can get a lot of attention.
They can.
Negative one, and still it will get, you know, promoted by robots.
Which brings us into the current system of peer review, which is something else you mentioned to us, is that you highlight the particular point was that, you know, you can submit to a journal and then it goes off review. The journal decides they don't want it, so you submit to another journal, it goes off review again, and you can get the same comments back, and it just bounces around. And it's a huge waste in time and money and effort. So, have you ever thought about using something like Review Commons or one of the other preprint review servers?
Actually, I'm not so sure if I heard about it. So you can.
So there's Review Commons is kind of the most well-known one, but there's a few now where basically they will review your preprint. The idea being that you can then submit the reviews with your preprint to the journal.
Wow.
If the journal's taking part. And then the idea being that, of course, it means you don't have to go through these constant rounds of revisions.
Ah, I see. Yeah, definitely. I would be using that. I just remember we were trying to publish or send this preprint to Nature Methods, and they had option that you can actually get this feedback, as you said, but they won't ask us. You have to pay for it, like £1,000-£2,000. So it was no way.
Yeah. There's. So I think Review Commons is free, but there is one of the big ones that's getting, or at least trying to get quite a lot of attention across Twitter is one that you have to pay for, but it is tiered paying, so you, like, if you're from a country where there's not a lot of funds for research, it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah, we're actually trying now to publish because they said at the end no, so we're now trying eLife, and I have to say eLife is great in this. They are so fast, so open, and hopefully they should give us at the end like a list what we should improve, just based on that four reviewers will just discuss that before they will send it to us, and then everything will be published together with the paper. So this is really great, right?
And I'm glad you said that, because we've just teamed up with eLife to do some podcast stuff in the coming months.
Amazing.
So we're probably going to be seeing a lot of nice things to them. But you said that and you're not paid by them, so that helps a lot. So you've also mentioned sort of the workload aspect that PIs are under. So they've got teaching to do, they've got an incredible amount of admin to do.
Yeah.
And one of the things you bring up, and it's something I also bring up a lot, and I'm interested to ask you this next question, actually. So you suggested that it would be really good to have sort of like a permanent postdoc position. And I think quite a lot of people think a permanent postdoc position would be great, because there's a lot of people who never want to be a PI, they just love being in the lab. Personally, I hate being in the lab. So having suggested that, is that a career track, if it was available, would you take that career track?
Definitely for me, yeah. Oh, okay. I would love to do this. Because to be PI, it's so complex, and you have much less time to actually do the cool science. So if this would be possible for me, you know, I would definitely take it.
I agree as well. I just thought I'd jump in that I really like being in the lab, and I like that side. I feel like being a PI is kind of almost a separate job. Mm. Like it doesn't feel like it follows on particularly well from what we do in the lab to then suddenly be like a manager I really like being in the lab and love what I do at the minute. So I would also take that if anyone's out there listening.
Emma would like a job.
Everyone like a postdoc job, please.
So the reason I framed it that way is just because quite a lot of the people I've spoken to who suggest this, and I'm very much one of these people, are people who would never actually do it. So it's interesting to hear people who would love to do that as a career, because a lot of people I hear suggesting it are people who actually want to be PIs and are just, maybe they're just suggesting it to get rid of the competition. I don't know. But it is interesting because, like I said, personally, I hate the lab. That's not what I like doing. I think I'm the world's worst postdoc, honestly. I can't be good.
For me, like transition from postdoc to PI, it's like complete something different. Like you need so much more skills you couldn't train during your postdoc. And now you are in it on your own. You are lonely, you know, and you have to learn this. And if you fail in first 2 years, then bye bye, you know.
Yeah.
So it's really tough.
Yeah, and I liked your sort of description you gave when you put this idea across, which was that you'd have, you know, maybe 50% of this person's time would be what the lab was doing, and then the other 50% you actually had as your own time to do your own research. That I thought was a really cool idea, because then you get almost the best of both worlds.
I believe actually this system is working in some countries or in some institutes, but not everywhere. I mean, it'd be great if this would be like normal, right? Yes, you could compete much more with other labs. You could keep the know-how, you know, of the methods, and also you would be able to tell what's here, because I found we have so much antibodies, so much different things, materials, drugs everywhere, and nobody knows about it. And you keep buying new. So, you know, this problem, right? It could be much more cost effective than it's now.
Yeah. I think some places in America do it where when they're made professors, they have it written into their contract that they have like a permanent postdoc or permanent research assistant. Hmm. Where I used to work in Cambridge, they had I think they had two positions actually in the end, where they had postdocs whose job was to do like things like maternity cover. So they were permanent postdocs and they would just go around the labs and cover as people were off and as they were needed. Mm. And that seemed to work really well. And that I think is a shame we don't see a lot more of as well.
Mm. But I think the main problem is also like the funding, right? If it's not stable position, it's only funded for a couple of years. And then if you're lucky, you get new funding and then new funding. Yep. Funding. But at some point, for example, in the lab, which is next to us, basically they had this nice postdoc guy. He was basically doing this like for a long time, and he was there, he was great, but then he was not unsure because of the pandemic, you know, if he will get the money to continue. So actually he got the option to apply for a different position, and now he has his own lab, you know. So actually it's great for him.
Yeah,
that's the thing. If it would be like stable position alongside not funded by grants, you know, it'd be much better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So last question I've got for you. You've already mentioned that how you met your PI. But you, the story you gave us was that you met him because he was the only one who stayed up drinking with PhD students at a conference, which I mean, we're all for that. We think that's a great way to vet PIs. The ones who are willing to do that are usually the nice ones in the lab as well, actually. So what has your experience of academia been, just kind of overall? Have you had quite a good experience, or has there been anything that was rough and difficult?
Oh, rough and difficult. You struggle during experiments that they aren't working, you know, and I think everybody experienced that, right, in the lab. So I'm always trying to do like 300% more of work than I actually need to have like 50% of that, you know. So yeah, otherwise than that, I was very lucky that always my PI was always like good, great, or at least I found some his characteristics, you know, which fit really well, and I use it top of my advantage.
Well, thank you so much. That was really, really interesting, and I can't wait to see this published.
Thank you that I could speak about it here. It was really lovely to see you and to hear you, and I'm really glad that actually you find me and send the email that I could actually talk about it.
It was a really interesting paper. I mean, we couldn't not.
Yeah, it was our pleasure having you on, and I might be in contact in a bit for, like, you know, maybe helping use that at some point, hopefully. Share the knowledge. Definitely. Right.
Definitely. I'm planning to now to send all the plasmids to Gene.
So, oh, amazing.
Yeah, I was trying to do it the way that everybody can follow it, so I was trying to publish all the protocols I was using, I was making on Figshare, which is basically like a repository, you know, for these kind of things. Yeah. All the maps I put there, now I'm trying to send things to Gene, that people actually could be using that. Yeah. And one more thing I forgot to tell you, let me sell it. By using our Dexcom system, you can actually target independently different alleles of the same gene.
Ooh. cool.
Because every gene, every allele can give you the expression level you need. Because if you do it without the Dexcom module, basically you will not see, it will be too low. You will not see anything on microscope, you know, on microscopy. But if you use Dexcom module, you can independently target different alleles, the same gene. And I did it for RAP11B. So I actually was able to modify one allele with M neon green fluorescent and second one with M cherry. So, but in theory, you can do it like any gene. So you can like imagine like tumor suppressors or oncogenes. You can have one allele mutated, like, you know, like P53. Only one allele is enough to make unfunctional the whole, you know, P53 tetramer. So you can tell, in theory, you can image inside one cell mutant and wild type, you know, gene, which is, I think, really cool.
It just keeps, Emma's sold. Emma's.
I'm already sold. My brain was just like, but in Alzheimer's, there's like different alleles for different mutations for the APO and APO4 and APO2 and 3 and stuff like that. We could have a look and see all together with those things. My mind's racing.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was lovely talking to you. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. And that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchived licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio fellows.